So now I'll just introduce Tess. So Tess Dimos is an activist out of Monash University. She's the National Union of Students campus representative, and she's also active in the campaign against racism and fascism here in Melbourne. Tess will give an introduction, and then afterwards we'll have time for discussion and so on. But first, if you could please put your hands together for Tess.
Okay, well, this is a talk on Clara Zetkin's radical theory of fascism and the United Front. And a part of the reason for, I think, looking at Zetkin's theory is that it was an attempt to try and create an analysis of fascism, a Marxist analysis of fascism, and how to confront it in some of the most extreme conditions in which fascism emerged. It was a theory that she developed in 1923 in Germany, and this was the most intense economic, political and social crisis that had ever been seen in an advanced capitalist country. It was developed in the context of the rise of what would become the most extreme form of fascism, the Nazi regime in Germany, with like mass organisations of politically motivated thugs, and the very extreme revolutionary working class struggle that was inspired by the Russian Revolution, seeking to create a whole new way of running society based on the principles of socialism. This theory was developed out of the practice on the ground of the German communist workers and the attempts by the party and the Communist International to try and come to grips with confronting the new developments in German politics, the emergence of a sizable, politically influential fascist threat, the invasion of the Ruhr section of Germany by the French, and the incapacity of the bourgeoisie to stabilise the situation without collaborating with the fascists. And in the face of all of this, the passivity of the largest workers' organisation in Germany, the German Social Democratic Party. And a lot of the theory of fascism in the United Front, it's worth saying, in this context in which it was sort of first emerging, was quite unclarified and vague. And I think the German communists did make a whole series of mistakes, not in the least the mistakes that led to there never being a working class seizure of power in Germany in 1923. But they were the beginnings of attempting to develop a new way forward for communists in fighting against fascism, to develop a sort of third way between the passivity of the Social Democrats and some of the mistakes of the ultra-lefts in Italy in trying to stop the rise of Mussolini. And a whole bunch of these sort of concepts, practices on the ground and theories would later be used by Trotsky to develop a much more concise understanding of fascism in the United Front that I think can help us today in learning about fascism, capitalism, workers' struggle and the orientation that communists can take to this. So I did want to spend some time looking at the context in which these ideas were argued, because I think it can give a whole bunch of clarity in trying to understand what is the purpose of the United Front. The context of 1923 Germany, as I said, was a very extreme crisis of capitalism, not just in terms of an economic crisis, which is what's most often pointed towards in terms of what generated mass fascist movements, but also a full social and political crisis in that country. In terms of the economic crisis, it's the harshest year of the post-war economic crisis in Germany, the deepest which any advanced capitalist country had ever experienced. And it was like this sense that capitalism was collapsing around the German people. Poverty had just become a general state based on the most modern industrial production that existed in most places around the world. Nearly the whole of the working population suffered absolute pauperisation, and the petty bourgeoisie as a whole was utterly ruined at the same time. The only privileges that survived were those of the owners of capital and the larger sections of the means of production. The petty bourgeoisie, people living on investments, pensioners, retired people, possessors of fixed income, found themselves in poverty from one day to the next. Owners of blocks and flats saw that their rents were reduced to nothing. They had no more resources. They ended up selling them for next to nothing. Office workers' salaries were cut by between 50 and 90%, metal workers' wages had fallen from the equivalent of $30 to $25 to $14 in the space of 6 months. And during the particular week, from the 8th to the 14th of October, a Berlin metal worker earned what is the equivalent of between $2 and $3, which is hardly one-tenth of what they would have earned a week before. And stories that people, like anecdotes of people who are so desperate for food that trucks carrying potatoes would be scavenged by passers-by, drivers speeding off as people fell out of the back trying to grab a morsel. And in October, a miner had to work 1 hour to buy an egg, had to work a fortnight to buy a pair of boots. Suicides had reached massive levels that had never been seen before in that country. And there was no longer any differentiations of pay between the different occupations, between different levels of skills within those occupations, but just one sort of uniformly wretched condition for the working class. In terms of political crisis, I mean, these notions of private property, of order, of legality had just become a mockery. There was no sense of an attachment to parliamentary institutions or the right to vote or universal suffrage. All of these things had become meaningless in the context of such a massive economic crisis. Measures of social security collapsed, and with them all of the democratic ideologies that had been built up out of the struggles against the monarchy and some of the conditions of legality in Germany. There was a sense that it was like a balance sheet of defeat for capitalism, that all of these incredible advancements and achievements of industrial society had just led to an amassed ruin. And the capitalist class had no economic solutions out of the crisis for the mass of people, which related to them having no political solutions out of this crisis for the mass of people, again, which related to a mass social crisis. So both the fascists, supported by sections of the German industrial capitalists, and the communists, supported by millions of workers across the world, were gaining greater influence amongst the German masses. The fascists basically became a tool utilised by the government and the industrial capitalists to try and spread nationalism amongst the masses, an attempt in that context of intense crisis to win sections of the masses to the same side as German capital and beat the rest into line. They were gaining influence mostly amongst ex-soldiers and the petty bourgeoisie, seeking stability and a new brutal and violent order amongst crisis and catastrophe. Communists, calling for a revolutionary transformation of society to solve the crisis of capitalism, were winning working class control through the factory committees established across the country and linking up with the working class regime in Russia. And they were gaining influence almost solely amongst the working class. There were 90% working class membership at this point. So to break those two down, fascists, like, for context, had already taken power in Italy in October 1922. So right as this crisis is emerging in Germany, they staged the March on Rome and captured the state, which became a form of grotesque inspiration for the fascists in Germany. And fascists really emerged in Germany under the social democratic government, seeking a sort of reliable military force that could be used to break the back of the revolution that was spreading in January in 1919. The government that had been brought in by the 1918 revolution, the social democratic government, a revolution that had brought an end to the war, that had overthrown the Kaiser monarchy, and that had established organs of workers' control across the country, including factory councils and Soviets. By December, that government was looking for a more reliable force than the traditional military to break apart, that was being broken apart by soldiers mutinying and soldiers joining the revolution. And they established, through some of the senior generals, a essentially paramilitary force of volunteers called the Freikorps, which was used in January by the Social Democratic government to violently put down workers' attempts to seize power all across the country, marching them from region to crush workers' uprisings in an extremely bloody fashion. A whole range of leading members of the Communist Party died in those struggles. And they would be used again and again, not always successful in putting down uprisings, but always reliable to not change sides, many of the Freikorps that was created to crush the revolutionary workers would go on to join fascist gangs and organisations that eventually became the Nazi Party. The first key base for that party was in Bavaria, which was after the defeat of a revolution that temporarily declared workers' control. It was a form of politics that argued as a reaction against the communists and the centrist party in Bavaria, claiming the communist Jews struggling for a better world for the crisis of capitalism, blaming those people for the crisis of capitalism. And 1923 is really when that organisation began to gain a mass audience. Communist Party had only emerged 1 month after the 1918 revolution, splitting away from the Social Democrats to form an explicitly revolutionary party. They'd gone through a whole series of splits, amalgamations, mistakes of ultra-left adventurism and passivity that led to a number of defeats for the German working class and the German Communist Party. And they really struggled to gain and hold a mass audience and lead the working class to victory over those years of tumultuous fighting and rapidly developing political and social situation, not only because of the standard inflictions of capitalism that communists have to steel themselves against and try and deal with, from police raids, military put-downs, censorship, etc., but also because there was deep divisions within the Communist Party itself between the Marxists and the ultra-lefts, and a whole bunch of vacillations of the party leadership stemming from how young the party was, how inexperienced many comrades were in organising an independent revolutionary party seeking to lead the working class to victory. And yet, by 1923, the communist revolutionary aspirations were greater than at any other moment. They'd gained from 1920 to 1922 and 100,000 members, so they had about 250,000 members at the start of 1923. And to try and get a sense of how much influence they had at the time, there was only one election that can sort of demonstrate that, which was in a region in which the Communist Party had no base and had never run in before, which was called Mecklenburg-Strelitz, where they received 10,853 votes, which is about a fifth of the total vote, which is a pretty significant influence for a party that had not intervened into that area in any significant fashion. Quite significantly, they enjoyed a clear majority in August in the strike committees that had emerged in Berlin and Hamburg. These sort of developments were really intensified again in January 1923 with the French occupation of the Ruhr, which is a mining region in West Germany, which, with the redrawing of the map, was right on the border with France. It was a part of the attempts by the French capitalist class to try and seize greater sections of Germany. Since 1919, they'd been encouraging a separatist tendency in the Ruhr with the aim of embarking on a French imperialist domination of the continent. And obviously, it being a mining sector, it meant that it was quite an economically useful region to capture. And that really intensified the economic, social and political crisis in Germany as a whole. The German government, which was headed by the social democratic leader, Ebert, in a what they called a grand coalition with bourgeois parties, resolved to embark on what they called a policy of passive resistance to the occupation, which was trying to encourage nationalism amongst the workers and petty bourgeoisie in the Ruhr and forbidding any German from collaborating in the with the occupying authorities, which included with the nationalist strike of calling for German workers not to work for the occupiers, in particular suspending the railways. So the French generals and the German capitalists both ended up having this desperate this desperation to have the German workers on their side, the French generals seeking to exploit working class hatred for German managers and capitalists in order to keep the industry going in the interests of the occupation, and the German government generals and nationalists trying to tie, through nationalism, German workers' interests to that of their capitalists through what they deemed a protest strike. So you'd have like a director arrested, a mayor sentenced, an official deported, and they would start a strike by promising to pay the workers for the lost days lost working. But obviously both of these capitalist regimes were absolutely rotten, And there was a call from the Communist Party not to pick any sides, neither on the side of the working class. They were playing with them in order to meet their own needs, primarily of exploitation of that very class in the Ruhr. So to try and shore up support and basically brutalise anyone who didn't give it, the German government and military encouraged the intervention of nationalist forces of the extreme right, fascist groupings, into the Ruhr. German military complicity with the leaders of the nationalist gangs were scarcely hidden. There was a whole series of volunteers from paramilitary groups and fascist organisations and former members of the Freikorps that they roped in from all across the country to try and engineer support for German capital in the region. And there was to show how explicit it was, there was a meeting on the 20th of February between Ludendorff, who was the previous quartermaster general in Germany and was now a prominent fascist leader and will go on to participate in Hitler's Beerhof Putsch, between von Seeckt, who was the current commander-in-chief of the German army, and the general manager of Steins, which is the corporation in control of a whole series of mines in the Ruhr. And I quote, to discuss the conditions for the collaboration between the Reichswehr, the military, and the activists of the extreme right. That was explicitly what they were trying to achieve. So as I said, workers' interests did not correlate with any of these reactionary forces. But the intense contradictions of either capitalist class or the fascists in trying to get German workers on side did actually play out in practice. The prime motivator for workers in the Ruhr was poverty, and there was spontaneous resistance to all of these oppressors that began to develop. So seeing things like coal not being distributed to workers' families, which is what the unions and the factory councils were demanding, and instead they remained stockpiled in the mines until the occupiers would come and collect them, despite this call from the capitalist class of Germany for passive resistance, which was increasingly being shown to be a charade. There was a whole series of street demonstrations, of strikes, etc., that started to develop that would be put down from both sides, from the sides of the German military and the nationalists and the side of the occupying forces, including with tanks. There was one incident in Essen in which 62 workers were killed. So this is the context in which the Communist Party of Germany and the Communist International were attempting to come to an understanding of fascism, the extent of the fascist threat and the methods by which they could fight against it. And leading trying to develop that theory was Clara Zetkin. So Zetkin, just for a bit of background, she was the oldest leading member of the German Communist Party at 66 years old. She was really the personification of the link or the connection between the old pre-war SPD, Social Democratic Party, that had gone through decades of serious Marxist education and struggles, and this new explicitly revolutionary organisation that had taken inspiration from the 1917 Bolshevik-led insurrection and was trying to organise in the midst of revolution. She developed it and made an argument about it at the meeting of the Communist International on the 20th of June in 1923, right in the context of this massive crisis in Germany, where she, I would argue, presented the first serious discussion on fascism amongst the Communist International, a report and a resolution on fascism that was voted up. Her driving argument was the need to draw the entire proletariat into a struggle to defeat fascism. And she really stressed that the struggle against fascism is an urgent necessity, that while the workers' movement needs to confront all the forces of capitalist class and counter-revolution, fascism poses a particularly vicious and extreme threat, which wasn't necessarily the accepted norm. So to quote Zetkin when she was introducing the report, she said, "Fascism confronts the proletariat as an exceptionally dangerous and frightful enemy. Fascism is the strongest, most concentrated and classic expression at this time of the world bourgeoisie's general offensive. It is urgently necessary that it be brought down. This is true not only with respect to the historic existence of the proletariat as a class, which will free humanity by surmounting capitalism. It is also a question of bread, working conditions, and the quality of life for millions and millions of exploited. That is why the struggle against fascism must be taken up by the entire proletariat." So it's a form of counter-revolution that mobilised the masses with extreme violence against communists and workers' organisations. She also stressed the struggle against fascism needs to be a struggle of the working class in particular, which is can be obvious to some people, but I think it's worth reiterating. The working class is the only force that has the interest and the power to oppose fascism and the capitalist order that generates it. Mostly that is about making the argument that the bourgeoisie cannot be depended on to stand up to fascism and resist fascism, including the liberal bourgeoisie, who fascists often target and can be portrayed as the enemy. So Zetkin argued that the result of the crisis of capitalism and primary motivation was creating a new form of bourgeois order via the destruction of every form of proletarian power. That the capitalist class don't see fascism as a preferred model, but as a last result, it is better than being able to restart the economy, than being unable to restart the economy and assert political legitimacy in the context of a left-wing workers' movement. So, for instance, she talks about the Alliance of Order that developed in Italy. This was after serious struggles in Turin, a movement of factory councils that had emerged in the industrial heartland in Italy, when the bourgeoisie was trying to regain control of society, and they created an alliance of order to try and re-stabilise Italian society under bourgeois control, in which they invited Mussolini's fascist party to participate in. And in Germany, in the Ruhr, you can see from what I've described, the collaboration between the industrial mining capitalists and the fascists, as well as the collaboration between the government that involves sections of the Social Democratic Party and obviously the liberal bourgeoisie and the fascists. Okay, she also stressed the struggle against fascism can't be a struggle just of communist workers, and this is a big part of her theory of the United Front, but that it has to be a struggle of the entire working class. She argued that confronting fascism is something that all sections of the proletariat movement can be united behind, and the mass character of fascist movements mean that they need to be confronted by a mass force that draws in as broad layers as possible. Confronting fascism is obviously going to come up against the forces of capitalist class rule, and we need to be able to pose an alternative way out of the crisis of capitalism, which would require the united action of the proletariat. Again, to quote Zetkin, she said, "Fascism rouses and sweeps along the broad social masses who've lost the earlier security of their existence, and with it, often their belief in social order." Demobilising the layer of middle class mobilised by the fascists and pulling the broader middle class behind a left-wing workers' movement, that is actually going to require putting forward a stronger force that is more powerful than a dictatorial capitalist state, as the fascists are arguing for. And in making this argument, Zetkin put forward a resolution on tactics for confronting fascism to the Comintern. And these tactics were designed precisely to try and draw the broadest possible layers of the proletariat into a struggle to defeat fascism. To establish an anti-fascist body involving as many organisations of the working class movement as possible, that would mean a mass powerful body in Germany involving, for instance, the Communist Party, individual members, the trade unions that are connected to the Communist Party, the factory councils that the Communist Party have been elected into, as well as the same institutions that are connected to the Social Democratic Party. And the actions of this united front include educating the workers and broad layers on the threat of that fascism posed, establishing contingents of self-defence, so factory-based fighting contingents, which actually were established in October in 1923 and were extremely important in defending the workers' movement from the threat of fascism. The political struggle against fascism, participating in parliament, was a key thing that Zetkin raised, and an international workers' boycott of Italy, which is a part of a key political task that she believed was to hammer into the minds of workers in all countries that the fate of the Italian working class would be their own if they don't confront fascism with vigorous revolutionary struggle. And Zetkin wasn't just attempting to try and theorise fascism and organise against it from a blank slate. She was working in the context of opposing theories of fascism and anti-fascist struggle in the socialist movement that were a complete dead end. She was attempting to intervene into the situation in Germany and direct the communist left internationally, desperately seeking to mobilise the forces of the workers' movement to confront the rise of fascism. And a part of this is seeing fascism's strength and mass appeal partially in the failures of the proletarian leadership and the betrayals of the reformist leadership. Zetkin argues that in Italy, fascism developed prior to the failings of the proletarian leadership, but it was developing slowly and weakly at first due to the strength of the socialist movement. Zetkin held back by the masses' faith in socialism. So it's not to argue that it requires a failure on behalf of the socialist movement for fascism to rise and to gain a mass audience, but that it can be incapacitated by mass socialist organisations. So she argued that socialists must counter fascist way out of the crisis of capitalism with their own, be it an alternative source of mass appeal that can carry behind it the middle class or at least demobilise them from fascism. In Italy and Germany, the reformist leadership demonstrated their incapacity to lead a way out of the crisis. If you look at the coalition compromises that happened in both of those countries, and the example in Germany of the SPD taking government without actually solving the crisis that then developed in a much more intense way in 1923. Furthermore, the Communist parties failed to lead the working class to taking power despite the mass revolutionary struggles due to the mistakes of the party. You can look at the leadership and the lack of political clarity in 1919 to 1920 in the revolutionary movement in Italy, with workers seizing control of factories in the industrial town of Turin, but losing the opportunity to take that struggle forward and develop it into a revolutionary seizure of power across the country. With that lost opportunity, it opened the pathway for fascism to gain a mass appeal. So breaking those two groups down, the Social Democrats, I mean, people might conceive of their arguments as not being worth considering because, you know, counter-revolutionaries, they helped establish the forces that would go on to lead the fascists, but I think they are worth considering because in this context, because they were organisations that held the largest number of workers in them and dominated the consciousness of the working class. And the key characteristic of Social Democrats in this context was that they had an extraordinary passivity in the face of the rising fascist movements that Zetkin was desperately attempting to reverse. They not just underestimated the threat of fascism and underestimated its capacity to come to power. It was much more than this. It was that Social Democrats were committed to the maintenance of capitalism and belief in the unshakable strength of capitalism, and were unable to conceive of any alternative to capitalism, so feared the sort of independent, out of their control, revolutionary working class struggle with the capacity to overturn every capitalist institution and form of order. They feared that more than they feared fascism. And that, I think, was demonstrated in practice from the role that the Social Democratic Party in Germany in 1919 played in trying to utilise every resource to ensure that workers' struggle didn't extend beyond their control and beyond the bounds of what capitalism could tolerate. And when that was unsuccessful, crushed workers' struggle with brutal force, in the example that I raised before of trying to mobilise the Freikorps against workers' uprisings. So when faced with the prospect of workers' control, they turned to counter-revolutionary violence. This is certainly not to say that Social Democrats didn't oppose fascism or want to see its demise. It's to point out that they would not oppose fascism in the form of working class revolution. They couldn't comprehend of an analysis of fascism that required a rejection of capitalism and an understanding of workers' capacity to self-govern. Within that limitation, there was various Social Democrats came up with different ways of analysing what fascism represented. Zetkin specifically critiques Otto Bauer, in which he looks at fascism as another form of bourgeois terror, a bourgeois reflex against the violence that was unleashed and threatened by the proletariat, and views basically any uprising by the working class and by the like communist-led workers as a, I don't know, I suppose, threat to capitalism and fascism as its attempt to push back against that, calling the Russian Revolution the proletariat's original sin. So basically viewed fascism as an expression of capitalism's strength and unshakability when the proletariat pushes, the capitalist class pushes back even harder. That analysis ends up justifying an argument for the working class not to struggle in the first place. So, like, Zetkin explained it as the proletariat is not up to the task of taking up the struggle against it. That would be foolhardy and doomed to failure. They feared that independent working class activity more than they feared fascism. And there's a whole series of other theories in which social democrats came up with at the time, but they all end up leading back to that same argument of not struggling in the first place. Then there's the role of the ultra-lefts and the arguments of the ultra-lefts, which had a prominent position in a whole range of communist parties across Europe. But even within the German Communist Party, there was a sizable ultra-left minority that made up around 30% of the party. And this was a key force that Zetkin was attempting to appeal to and mobilise in taking up the united front against fascism. The ultra-lefts, it can seem contradictory as though they're on the opposite end of the social democrats, but it's worth saying that they were also very much characterised by passivity in the face of the rise of fascism, viewing fascism as just another form of counter-revolution on par with the bourgeois parties and the social democratic parties, all of which wanted to see the revolutionary struggles of the international working class smothered and were willing to resort to brutal violence. But it was more than that. It was that they saw fascist movements as most similar to the social democratic parties, pretending to be the friend of the suffering masses whilst concealing their counter-revolutionary intentions. So at the fifth conference of the Comintern in 1924, Bordiga, the leader of the Italian Communist Party, described it as fascism fundamentally merely repeats the old game of the bourgeois left parties, meaning the social democratic parties, i.e. it appeals to the proletariat for civil peace. It attempts to achieve this aim by forming trade unions of industrial and agricultural workers, which then leads to practical collaboration with the employees' organisations. And the Italian Communist Party threw its energy into a merciless critique of the leaders of the Social Democratic Party and rejected any notion that an anti-fascist alliance with them could be set up. The problem with this analysis led not simply to passivity in the face of fascism, an inability to involve workers beyond the membership of the Communist Party. Its attempts to appeal to the hundreds of thousands of workers in the Italian Social Democratic Party were reduced to extreme and often unbelievable critiques and accusations against the Social Democratic leadership. And in Germany, you can see a similar thing playing out when the ultra-lefts were trying to intervene into the Ruhr, trying to engineer a seizure of power with whatever limited support they already had and not trying to find ways of mobilising and winning over broader sections of the working class. Zetkin's counter theory to both of these was the united front was an attempt to mobilise the working class when a very sizable portion of the class was being led by the Social Democratic Party, encouraging passivity in the face of reaction. So a key part of that argument was the need to understand the character and the threat of fascism as being different to other counter-revolutionary offensives, arguing that military means alone cannot vanquish it. We must also wrestle it to the ground politically and ideologically. And a part of this is seeing that in contrast to the Social Democrats, fascism isn't a sign of capitalist strength. It's a sign of its weakness. It's a sign of the decay of the capitalist system in Germany at the time. And within that decay, the illegitimacy amongst the masses and inability to chart a course out of that crisis by the sort of more traditional bourgeois parties. She said, fascism rouses and sweeps along the broad social masses who've lost their earlier security of their existence and with it often their belief in social order, in particular mobilising the middle class who were afraid of being proletarianised or pushed further into poverty and losing any possessions that they owned. So it's a form of counter-revolution that takes counter-revolution to the extreme. And it's not just a form of counter-revolution that is the sort of go-to of the capitalist class, but a last resort in an attempt to try and stabilise and maintain their order. So Zetkin's argument was trying to win the international communist movement and the German Communist Party to the strategy of the United Front. The United Front being united action of workers from different political tendencies and organisations in action against a common enemy and around a concrete set of demands that can be agreed on by both or by multiple parties. And in practice, this played out in a whole bunch of different ways in Germany, sometimes very successfully. So in 1922, there was a response from the German party to right-wing death squads that had emerged after the assassination of the German foreign minister that led to joint mass strikes between the Social Democratic Party and the Communist Party, workers' self-defence organisations, or the Proletarian Hundreds, that involved workers from different political tendencies in joint action. And the Communist Party appeals to the Social Democrats for a united front, sometimes forced Social Democrats to take action, fearing the threat of fascism against themselves or fearing working-class independent action outside of their control. Many times they refused, but regardless of what action they took, whether they agreed or refused, Social Democratic workers, in large part, joined the United Action with the Communists because of these appeals for united working-class action. And as I said previously, the party ended up growing by 100,000 members by the end of 1922. So this was a method of engaging workers outside the Communist Party under hostile leadership in joint action. And it was not just dreamt up by Zetkin, it was developed through worker struggles on the ground against the counter-revolutionary coup in the industrial town of Chemnitz in 1919. And it was something that she had taken from those struggles on the ground to try and conceptualise as a way of combating fascism in a much larger scale. The orientation behind the resolution that Zetkin put forward was that you can draw as many sections of the workers' movement as possible into united action against fascism actively in terms of workers' self-defence guards, ideologically in terms of educating the working class around the threat of fascism, and politically, she argued, by joint efforts in Parliament. There are some problems, I think, with Zetkin's conception of the United Front and understanding of use of the United Front by the Comintern and the KPD, which are worth raising to try and understand what are some of the limitations or fallbacks, problems that you can get into in imposing that strategy. One was just the real lack of clarity that existed at the time. So the German Communist Party and the Comintern's analysis of the United Front in general was very confused. For instance, in the discussion of Zetkin's report, the Comintern representative of the German party, Karl Radek, made a speech which has gone down translating into the Schlageter turn. And in that speech, he effectively hailed a fascist martyr for giving his life for the German people, just not for the right cause. And the Schlageter turn ended up being building on but massively distorting Zetkin's arguments for educating the working class on the threat of fascism and combating fascism politically and ideologically, not just militarily, and led to serious debates between the communists and the fascists for who could gain influence amongst a similar audience. Debates in public forums, publishing debates with the fascists, including their arguments and responses in their newspaper, and occasionally pushing too far towards nationalism in an attempt to win over people in the audience of the fascists. There's no evidence that I can find that this actually gained results for the KPD. I think it would have been far more useful in demobilising the petty bourgeoisie to direct efforts towards strengthening the workers' movement, capacity to create a new society is demonstrated by that strength, than trying to win over the most backward sections of German society, regardless of how oppressed some of those people may have been. It did lead to extreme slander and ridicule of the organisation. But it's worth saying this is not just that someone had a different opinion to Zetkin. Zetkin didn't rebut Karl Radek when she had the opportunity to at the end of her speech. She didn't raise any disagreements with it within the party when the Schlageter turn was taken up in practice by the German communists. So it's not just that people misinterpreted it, but I think in general there was a lack of clarity in how to actually impose these new ways in which they were trying to work out how to combat fascism. There was also a lack of clarity about how to deal with the counter-revolutionary character of the Social Democrats and Reformists. So in calling for united action between Communists and Social Democrats, I think you have to openly recognise the role that Social Democrats have played in undermining workers' struggle and account for how to deal with this. Zetkin's analysis of fascism puts part of the blame for the rise of fascism at the feet of the Social Democratic parties, but she doesn't clarify how to engage with them in the United Front given those actions and intentions. She doesn't cut against or politically prepare for potentials of communist parties to subordinate their politics into the politics of the Reformists, which is exactly what the Reformists would be hoping for, to use the United Front as a way to demobilise the communist parties. And at no point does she outline what the politics and political debates within the collaboration would be, how to convince people to be involved, what the role of the communist parties in relation to the Social Democrats would be, etc. And in fact, I think it's unclear whether she thinks it would be a brick wall to engaging in such an alliance if it meant subordinating your politics, because obviously it's not guaranteed that Social Democrats will want to enter into an alliance of the United Front. Do you subordinate your politics or not? And one example of that, I think, is the real stress that she put on what she called the workers' government, which she said is the slogan is virtually a requirement for the struggle to defeat fascism. But it does raise the question of what is a workers' government. Everyone had a different conception of what this thing would be. In Zetkin's arguments for what the German Communist Party should practically be involved in, it meant a government formed out of the political parties connected to the working class movement. This is clearly not workers' power, it's a government for the capitalist state that's made up of representatives of the political parties that had large working class membership, based on a key set of demands that pushed towards workers' control and revolution, such as disarming the fascists and arming the workers. And that took different forms, whether it could be agreed upon to enter into or not, based on whether those demands were accepted. There were massive differences of opinion on. But I think it's a false compromise. There's nothing to be gained for the working class by communists entering into a capitalist government, for instance, even if it's on the most favourable grounds. For instance, in Saxony-Thuringia in October 1923, when the left section of the Social Democratic Party accepted the demands of arming the workers, of disarming the bourgeois formations, of workers' control over production, of emergency measures to provide food, and a call to form a workers' government for the whole of the Reich. The Communist Party ended up getting 3 members in government. They still remained powerless to do anything real to implement any of those aims, including to arm the working class in the face of a serious potential for revolution. Instead, the workers' government became an extremely conservative drag on the Communist Party, effectively delaying the plans for revolution and leading to a military occupation, and at the very least the potential for workers to hold a mass strike, if not begin moves towards a revolution, whilst the communist leadership was paralysed to provide any leadership to that class. So instead of the United Front being a way of mobilising the working class, otherwise paralysed by their leadership, it became a way of paralysing the Communist Party leadership in a situation where the class could otherwise be mobilised. And I think that points to a key part of the United Front, which is that revolutionary politics has to come first. It's the entire basis for entering into a United Front, a recognition that only a revolutionary undertaking can ultimately defeat fascism. And that is a part of demonstrating through that United Front, through that practice, the superiority of revolutionary politics and of revolutionary struggle to try and win over sections of the workers in the Social Democratic parties to the Communist Party. Okay, just to wrap up, I think out of this, like, Zetkin clearly attempted to mark out a path for the international communist movement to move towards revolution and in the process defeat the rise of fascism. Her orientation was a massive step forward, I think, from the two orientations of the sections of the socialist movement beforehand. But it was not really taken up. It was attempted in the year of 1923. By the following year, Comintern Conference voted up an alternate strategy, an ultra-left orientation that argued social democracy and fascism were just two sides of the same coin. And that position would soon be taken up by the counter-revolutionary Stalinist regime and imposed on the rest of the communist parties around the world precisely to immobilise the revolutionary leadership of the working class. In my opinion, while we need to go beyond Zetkin, and it's worth recognising that a whole bunch of these ideas were later taken up by Trotsky and theorised in a more concise way, her theory of fascism can help guide our analysis, and her attempts to redress the issues of the ultra-lefts and the social democrats should be recognised as opening up the pathway for a third way, a Marxist method for challenging fascism that we should look to. In terms of the application of the United Front more broadly than this, I think it's worth saying, because it does get raised a lot, that the United Front is not the be-all and end-all of struggling against fascism as a sort of 12-step program to defeat fascists that can be implemented every time a tiny fascist group emerges with whatever forces are available. For instance, in our campaign, in the campaign against racism and fascism in Melbourne, it often gets raised that we need a united front, which is actually just a campaign group of any activists who want to be a part of it, of about between, 15 and 40 people, that is a united front to try and combat the fascist threat in Melbourne. I think examining the arguments that were being made in the 20s as well as the mistaken implementations can help us understand the purpose of the United Front, which is not just to confront fascism, but it's about mass working class resistance to fascism in the face of a working class that is pacified by their leadership, and attempt through those struggles to win wider layers of the working class to revolution and demonstrating the superiority of revolutionary politics in practice.